So hi everybody, welcome along to the class, and those of you online, welcome. So just adding a little something, if those books are up there and you're interested in this topic, grab one. There's a lot of information in there that will be, which I can't expand on today, but it's about the lesson today. And it is very useful. It's nice to structure anyway. Okay, so we'll begin as we normally do. We'll do a short meditation, and we'll say some prayers together, and then I'll begin the class. And during the class, there's a place to set out for actual questions to be asked about the material. So please, if you've got questions, please write them down first. You know, so while I'm talking, you might get really excited and I've got this question. Please write it down, because otherwise we will not finish the class. There's a lot of detail in this material. Okay, so please get comfortable in your seat. This means that your back will be straight and your shoulders relaxed. You can place your hands wherever they feel most comfortable, and you can either close your eyes or keep them open. And once you are comfortable in your seat, let your body breathe itself. While the body is breathing itself, just relax into awareness. And from within that state of relaxed awareness, imagine the ground beneath you is made of starry sapphire light, which is very, very light and soft as a cloud. And while the ground beneath you feels this way, imagine that space is filled with rainbows and offerings. And within that space, imagine that a throne appears. And on that throne are cushions of lotus, sun, and moon. And sitting upon the moon seat is Buddha Shakyamuni. Is golden in colour, wears the robes of a monk, and he's surrounded by an assembly of other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, deities, and enlightened beings. You yourself are surrounded by all sentient beings. But beside you are sitting your mother and father, closest friends and family, strangers and difficult people. And you take the time now to recollect how fortunate you are to still be alive. And while you are alive, you have the leisure and opportunity to attain whatever spiritual goal you set your heart upon. You must act quickly, because death could take place at any moment. Not only that, things are not quite right. And our world does not exist as it seems to. Nevertheless, we have met a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones. The enlightened Buddha, which is the actual deepest nature of your own mind. The Dharma, which are the teachings of this Buddha, but also the realizations that you contain within the mind. And the Sangha, the spiritual beings who embody the teachings of the Buddha. You also have your own Sangha, which is the collection of good qualities you have. So you can rely upon the outer three rare sublime ones and your own inner three rare and sublime ones. To make this offering of practice as purely as possible, I want you to imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. And your body will now appear to you as a light, which you actually sort of see through completely. And while your body is as clear as a deity, you're holding a vajra and bell to remind you of emptiness and the mind of enlightenment. And you're sitting within a sphere of great bliss. So in front of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and all the enlightened beings, imagine that your hands are joined together, or actually press them together in the prayer mudra. And then join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of yours, imagine that from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectars stream down. And these dissolve in yourself and all the living beings surrounding you. So your own negative karmas and obstructions and those of others are purified. All of your good qualities, your virtues, your realizations, along with your health and lifespan, are increased. I think that you've been purified by wisdom and empowered by love. Recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. Desire to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into those four states. And to affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So again, from the heart of each enlightened being above you, lights and nectar stream down, and these dissolve in yourself and all living beings surrounding you. Negative karmas and obstructions are purified. Your health and lifespan are increased, along with your virtues and realizations of Dharma. So feeling completely empowered, exhale and allow yourself to relax a little more. And then from that relaxed state of awareness, invite the field for accumulating merit, which appear. And you say before them, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So having purified our body, speech, and mind and accumulated merit, but with the awareness that we do not wish to cling or grasp to this as inherently existent, we imagine that our body, speech, and mind, all of our possessions and virtues, are utterly transformed into a pure land. And this is the pure land where all beings can take teachings from us in the future. And we offer this to the Buddha and his entourage. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of effort. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamaya Tayami. So I've released the offering, and the offering has been accepted by the Buddha, and he smiles at you with delight. And we look up into the eyes of the Buddha and we meet his gaze. Well, within the gaze of the Buddha, we recollect a wish to abandon suffering and its causes. That we wish to do this to benefit all sentient beings. And this depends upon the correct view that all phenomena lack inherent existence and do exist through conceptualization and awareness. Recollecting these three principal aspects of the path, we aspire to be fully awakened ourselves. So induced by our wishes and our prayers, there emerges from the Guru Buddha a second figure who absorbs into you. And now your form clearly becomes that of Guru Buddha. And radiating from the home of your heart, light rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you and place them in the state of full enlightenment. So yourself and all the Buddhas surrounding you have at the heart a moon disc, a little yellow home at its center, encircled by the mantra. Shakyamuni Buddha, and you begin to recite Jayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha Jayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha Jayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. You can hear the sound of it reverberating, so under your breath you can recite the mantra a few more times. Jayata Muni Muni Mahamunaya Soha. So I think the two purposes have been achieved. In other words, you've accomplished your own enlightenment and you've been able to establish all beings within the very same field of enlightenment. In other words, all beings have become fully awakened. Now I think that through the virtue of this practice, even though it was one of imagination, nevertheless it's planted seeds for our own awakening to benefit others. To think, may we quickly achieve the state of a Guru Buddha and place all sentient beings without exception in that very same state. And now breathing in through nostrils. Exhale through mouth. At your own time, with your eyes flush open. And please move your body around in whichever way you desire to. Please feel once again quite comfortable and at ease. Okay, so we'll begin by looking at what we covered over the last couple of weeks, and we'll just do this briefly. So we've looked at the four karmic principles. So can you really remember what any of them are? What's the first one? That karma is definite. What's the second? The karma expands, great, or increases, or is it magnified? And the third? You never get an effect without a cause, right? Effects require causes. Results require causes, and these causes have to be supported but with conditions. And finally, what's the last one?
It's never lost.
Thank you, Scotty. Karma's never lost. The causes don't just vanish of their own accord. They remain until they're either decreased or wiped out completely by them. They just don't go away, in other words. We looked at how when an activity finishes, it's called a seed. So and these seeds are just what they call potentials for something else to happen. So it's the potential that gets magnified or increases over time. These karmic seeds are what they call the substantial causes of their effects. And karma is a volitional action, meaning it's basically intention. If you intend to do something, if you have a motive for doing something, that's the karma. But that's what they call cause. Karma is principally causal. And we sort of look at these mechanics of karma, which means basically that intentions always come before the action. And that the substantial cause turns into the effect, and cooperative causes and so forth support the effect. And we gave the example of using the plant, you know, the little seed of the ground. So today we're going to look at two major topics. What does it mean to have a complete karmic action? And in the coming weeks, we'll talk about what the consequences of that complete action are. So not all actions are complete. That's what we're sort of saying, but some are. And when they are, they definitely bring about their results unless they're stopped in some way. And when we choose to do things or have motives for doing things, they have a certain weight to them, or what we might call strength. Like, for instance, sometimes the example of holiness gives oftentimes is like when a mosquito bites you, you know, you might be just there and you hear it and you just don't like it, I guess. And so you go slap. You just do that. This is not very, it's really strong intention. You might even not even have the intention to kill it. You just want to like get rid of it. You don't, maybe you don't like the noise. But the activity actually kills it. So that is nowhere near as heavy if you really hate mosquitoes, right? And any time you feel or see them come in your room, you want to kill them. That's a much heavier action than just sort of, you know, slapping away at them. This is what we talk about with the weight. You know, this plays out in the world. If you go to a court, people who, for instance, deliberately murder somebody or kill somebody, that's seen in a much different light as if it was an accidental death. So there's a difference of weight in the motivation. And so we can talk a little bit about that too in terms of karma. Of course, the material I've drawn is from these four books, but also there's a lot of this that I've done is put into different tables. So if you go up after the class and you want to have a look at some of this, like Miffy says, she's got a few of them behind the desk. It's just a quick way of looking at it very quickly and getting the essential nature of it all. Otherwise, you've got to read a lot of material and try and put it together in your own mind. If you do take those books, I hope you'll find them useful. Now, so I'm going to start off with a quote by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, from a book called The Four Noble Truths. And I'll read it out to you and then just probably ask you, so what do you think that means? So the quote is, "It is important to appreciate that since there are different stages to every act, karmic actions themselves are composite, and their quality can be characterized as the cumulative result of their composing factors." Yeah, that's so we're talking about like every activity, in other words, has parts, and you can break the action down into its parts. But when you put all the parts together, you get some sort of result. And this result is the effect of having all those parts to come together. So in other words, karma isn't a simple thing. It's a process which has distinct stages. And so I'll do it first very simply now, but we'll come into more detail shortly. So over the weekend, Geshe Sultan was here and questions were asked about karma. And so I asked a few because I thought I've got good answers here and I can share them with you. He did it quite in a simple way, so I'll describe it to you first simply. So when you carry out an action, there are simply put this, the simplest way, this is not the way Geshe-la put it, I'll come to that next. The simplest way is that you do an action and it stops. You act and then you don't act. The act comes to an end. So there's a beginning and an end. That's the most simplest way of talking about actions. You begin them and they finish. They start and they stop. This is not actually about karmic action, right? Karmic action's got another part of it, and that is the intention. So you intend to act, and then the act finishes. It's got three parts: intention, action, culmination, or completion. The act is completed, it stops. That's stopping. When it stops, that's called the seed. It's the seed of a karma. That activity has a potential to create something else. For instance, if I'll use Laura as an example here. Suppose I get I look at Laura and I, for some reason or other, I don't like it. So I'm going to say something to hurt her. There's my intention. I say it, that's the action. And then I stop talking. That's the end of it. So that's left a potential on my mind stream. That's called the seed. Next time I see Laura again, like now I have this affliction, I have a disturbing emotion about it. It could trigger that seed again. So now I behave the same way. So these seeds are watered by afflictions. Now, it's not that I've said something nasty to Laura, it's not like it's over for me. Every time I see it, it's like I get the same idea. And so I try to do the same again. But perhaps I don't. Maybe I just see her, and in my mind, it goes, blah, 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 but I don't actually say anything. Right? So I make the karmic potential of more problems greater for myself. So the way Geshe-la explained it was quite simple. He goes, intention first. Then the activity. Then the activity finishes. Now, each of those parts, you can see it could have more parts, couldn't it? It's like, you must say, what was your intention, Eddie, to speak to Laura like that? Well, it might have been dislike, resentment, hatred, might be jealousy. Something quite different. Might be just, I'm mistaken for somebody else. So got that. And then, of course, out comes the speech, the activity itself. Now, the most important part of this, of course, I'll stop speaking. That's the end of the action. So the karma stuff is often simply presented as three parts: intention, action, culmination. But then each of those can be broken down. So when I carry out the action, like how did I speak to it? What words did I use? So it's got all parts too. And when it finishes, how does it finish for me? Perhaps I feel like a sense of glee about that, like I've got it. So I enjoy it. But perhaps I recognize, oh, it's the wrong person. Right? What? That's not the person I was meaning to speak to like that. I go, oh my gosh, sorry. I've said it, but now I go, wrong person. So now the whole thing's weakened. But still, the intention was there to cause harm. It's just the object was the wrong object. So there's a lot of, composing factors, as you can see in the quote. Composing factors, there are many of them. So when we talk about activities, the simplest way you can explain is three parts. I'll be explaining it mainly in four parts, but there's five, six, seven. And they're just what they're doing is just getting these major parts and breaking up into smaller parts. The point is to break it all down so you can see what paths are in play when you act. So here is this, which is quite a simple way of doing it. It's not as simple as the third, but I think it's got more depth in it. That's why I want to explain it that way. So a complete karmic action fulfills all four elements. So here's four parts. The basis, the intention, action, and combination. So you can see one extra thing has been brought in there, isn't there? The basis. So the basis in the example I gave was Laura, the person. Because it could have been, the basis might have been the TV set or the computer that wasn't working so well, so I screamed and shouted at that. So here's like four parts. So again, I use the example of an extreme action, killing. So what is the basis for killing? Well, it's going to be a living being. You can't kill something that's not alive, right? So the basis in this part would be the human being or an animal, just a living being. Then it's, what's your intention? Why do you want to kill this being? So that's the second one. Then there's the actual action of killing. So you know there's many, many different ways you can take the life of a living being, right? So you can see right there's many, many different ways. The weight or the heaviness of the karma will differ. And then finally, the culmination of the action is the being dies. The being has to die, otherwise it's not called killing. And when they die, something happens in your mind. It's like, is there joy in that? Are you satisfied in that? Or is it a mistake? Now, if all these four parts are all in place and they're sufficiently strong, they produce what they call strong results. The effect is also strong. If it's only partially complete, then you get a partial effect. The most important thing really to take away from this is that when all four parts are complete, that's the seed of karma. Right? And that seed has enough strength to produce a rebirth. All four parts have to be complete to get the effect of the rebirth. If they're not all in there, it cannot produce a rebirth, or produce a different type of effect. Which we'll come to in other classes. So karma produces many different effects. Most of the time, when you talk about it from a Buddhist perspective, it's the rebirth effect. They call it the fruition. What's the fruit of this seed? Buddhists are really concerned about the rebirth. So the key takeaway from this is to understand how a complete action creates for us the future experience, whether it be a rebirth, whether it be in terms of your behavior, whether it be in terms of what you experience, also your environment. So I was thinking about this the other day. I went through my material and I thought, oh, it's a good analogy. So it says, so a complete karma is like baking bread. You need all the ingredients. So the ingredients are the basis. You need to measure out all the stuff properly. Right? That relates to the thought and the intention. Then you've got to mix it all up, put it in the oven, right? That's the action. And then you've got to bake it for the proper amount of time to culminate into a successful baked dish. Now, if you don't do it like that, you don't get a very good baked dish at the end, do you? If you decide, oh, I'll leave the flour out, I won't turn the oven on. Or I forgot to turn the oven on, like everything is in place, but something got missed out. So you don't get the full effect of the baked cake. All have to be in place. All got to meet the right conditions, then it takes place. If it's not all in place, you get some other effect. So what we really want to take away from this, I guess, in terms of a practical application of our knowledge, is, you know, we're active all the time. We're saying things, we're thinking things, and we're doing things. or any of those things, I just look at it and go, okay, so what's the basis? Am I talking to a person? Because if I am, that's the basis. What's my thought about why I'm doing it? Meaning, what's my motivation? Why am I, what am I about to say and why? Then you will either act through your body or your speech. There's your action. And when it finishes, what's going on in your mind? So for most of us, I'm sure, we're just unaware of all that. But we just speak. We just sort of act. Then the consequences follow, and then that's where we get sort of really effective, right? And sort of, if we didn't mean to cause harm, it's too late, isn't it? But sorry, we say sorry. And it's because we weren't aware of what we're actually doing. So you see that in many of the, for most of us, one of the most practical ways of meditating is just to calm down, slow down. So you know, you have enough time to know, oh, I'm going to say this to Sandy. I've got a good reason for saying it. Right? So we know, okay, my motivation is clear to me. There's no intention here to hurt Sandy. I have something to say that I think might be beneficial and useful. And then, but of course, the activity takes place. But suppose I want to help Sandy, but in fact, my speech is rather harsh, or the tone is grating. Yeah, it's not so good then, is it? It's not as good as it could be. And then at the end of it, I look at, oh, Sandy didn't get it. So now there's no real enjoyment on my part, right? And I didn't get it across. Oh. So the action still took place, but it's not as powerful as it could have been. So with our virtue, with our good acts, then often nowhere near as powerful as our bad acts. Often, like when we want to say something that will be helpful to anybody, do we actually think that's what we want to do? Or do we just say something hoping it's going to help? You know, do we sort of pause before we speak to go, okay, so how am I going to get this across? I want it to be effective, but how? And then at the end, you sort of look at, do you rejoice? Do you feel joy in trying to help someone? Did you say something useful? Most of us, I'm sure, don't. Just it's like ordinary to us. But when we want to hurt somebody, when we don't want to hurt them, but we do, it's nearly always complete. I think it's one of the reasons they say that to take rebirth as a human being, which depends on this complete action, all four parts in place, all good and strong, is very, very rare, even though there seems to be a lot of humans on the planet. If you're looking at us in terms of all the other living beings here, we're a pretty small in number, actually. Now, of these four parts of the action, so you probably walk out here and forget this, but it's the most important part of it, how an action is composed. So this is my way of doing it. You don't have to follow it, but you've got to find a way. And it's a way of, you go like, okay, it's four parts. So you go, it's like the ABCs, right? There's an action, there's a basis, there's a completion, and there's an intention. Of course, they're not in that order, but that's a simple way of doing it. Just go ABC thought, or ABC I, ABC intention. Act is an action, yep, there's a basis, and it always stops. Or you can just go simply, you know, whenever I act, I always begin and I stop. But then there's a middle, right? So I've got action, I do an action, of course I do. And it's often towards somebody, either myself or a living being or something inanimate. But there's your basis, you're doing it for some sort of reason. There's your intention, and your action always stops. So you try and make it as simple as you can, and that's the beginning, right? We understand that process intellectually. But then again, of course, now comes the actual doing of it, which is not so easy because we're so quick, we're fast, right? Now, of these four parts of the action, The most important aspect is,
what is it?
The intention. That's right. That's the actual karma, the intention. The intention that lies behind the act. So intention drives the action. And this intention colors this action as either positive or negative, meaning is it virtuous or non-virtuous? Will it bring about a good result or a poor result? And there is bad, good, poor, bad stuff relates to you, not to the other person. We create these actions, we experience their results. Again, so in terms of the practical application of this knowledge is pause, just slow down and decide, why is it? What's my purpose? When I act, why? What am I trying to do here? That gets your motivation clean and clear. And like I said, this is all the rest might be a big mess, but at least you didn't intend to do it that way. Your intention was to either, or hopefully to be, help somebody. And beneath that deepest expression of you need to help should be this realization, as you see, you're not very good at it. I'm not. Well, we'd like to be better, we'd like to be good. But as we all know, what they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, sometimes said, right? Then it just makes me a little bit unskillful. Might have a good intention, but what follows is not very skillful. But like I said, nevertheless, that intention is the most important point. It's the intention. That's the karma. We might not be good in how we actually act, but we can actually slow down enough and make a good intention. So the virtuous karma, so intention determines whether something is virtuous or non-virtuous. So in other words, your motivation matters more than the visible action itself. So this is not, this is difficult for us. Most of us think the action is the most important thing, the verbal action or the physical action. You know, that's where we put all of our energy. In fact, the Buddhists go, that stuff won't go on into the next life. Your thoughts do, though. Your intentions do, your karmas, they do. So intention is of primary importance. And the analogy goes, intention is like the seed that determines what fruit your action will bear. You know, we talk about seeds, the seeds of karma. It's been complete, but it's the intention. Something's going to come out of that. That intention holds some potential for something. We will experience that. So this is what's so important, to have good intentions. And of course, the very best intention is the mind of enlightenment. Like, whatever I do, may it be a cause for your enlightenment. Whatever I do, when I get up in the morning, I wash my face, may this be an activity that will bring about enlightenment for all beings. Sounds a bit strange, I know, but this is if you can think of a better intention than becoming enlightened for all beings, say that one. And finally, these intentions are of different types. Like I said, so one type is like you could say they're virtuous or they're non-virtuous. They're positive, they're negative. And these intentions, they drive the activity. And so we'll come up to this weight and what the nature of these actions. So for instance, in terms of their harmfulness, like you say, so the nature of non-virtuous to create harm. And as you probably know, there's actions that are called non-virtuous, like killing. There's a non-virtue, a natural non-virtue. It has a greater weight than creating adultery, for instance. It has greater weight than stealing. It's a heavy, of all the activities you can do with your body, taking the life of another living being is much heavier than stealing from them. We all agree, natural justice in our systems, it all works like that, doesn't it? You have different sins of taking the life of somebody than for stealing. Now, if you look at taking the life of someone, there's many different ways you can take the life of somebody, right? So there are very terrible, nasty ways of doing it. Well, that way of doing it has greater weight than, perhaps a slap of a mosquito like that. So again, this is why I'm saying it's not a simple thing, this karma. So of the activities of our body, in terms of non-virtue, we have killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. Killing is heavier than the other two. Stealing is lighter than killing, but it's heavier than sexual misconduct. And of those three, sexual misconduct is the lighter. There are similar type of things when you look at verbal karma. You have a harsh speech, you have lying, and you have the other two. So each of those you can go to, this one here, after all, this is the heaviest. And then if you went to say to lying, you go, okay, because all sorts of lies you can tell. Which are the heaviest ones then? And then it might say, that depends upon who you're lying to. And then, okay, suppose I lie to my spiritual teacher. There's what sort of lie? Because all lies aren't equal. Right? So if I were to lie to my teacher about my realizations of emptiness, which aren't any, I'd say to him, yeah, I've done it. I'm doing really well. I had a great experience last night and so forth. That's a terrible lie in terms of imparting this knowledge to your spiritual mentor. So again, there's a lot in this. Today I'm reintroducing you to two types of it. One is, like I said, is sort of the basis, the intention, the action, and the culmination. That's one of the real simple ones of doing it, ways of doing it. So if you take that away, and then understand that within that though is all these other component parts. So in terms of when you come up to the last three, wrong views, malice, and the mental stuff. We have wrong views, malice,
and covetousness.
And covetousness, wanting what others possess. So they're not, they're put into the 10 non-virtues, but they're not actually karmas, these three. But of them, the worst is the wrong view. So it's like the wrong view, that's all karma doesn't exist. That's the wrong view, right? You might have the view that, no, really, there's a real substantially existing person, a real being person. In fact, that's a wrong view too. There's plenty of wrong views we have, and of them all, that's the worst, the wrong views. They point out 10 of them that you can have. Otherwise, I look at the four major ones of the speech and the three major ways of the activities of body. Now, there are many, many other wrong ways of behaving, but it's sort of like they sort of single those 10 out. Just to make it like this easier for us. And we go, look, if we just deal with this, it's enough. There are others too, but these are the most important. So do you guys have anything you'd like to say, any questions? Yeah, well, this is why you see when people become ordained, they don't talk a great deal. It's probably a good idea, isn't it? I was talking to somebody the other day, they said, better to be thought a fool than known to be one when you open your mouth. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so there's a great deal of what they call mindfulness, right? So mindfulness just basically means recollection or memory. So here we remember, my actions have got four parts to it, even when I speak. So you have to slow down and be deliberate. Yeah, so we ask like many of us quite spontaneous, meaning like we don't think a great deal about what we do. And Buddha's saying, yeah, that's the great problem. Not only do we not think about things in the correct way, but we actually think about them in the wrong way. So I said the most worst thing is a misapprehension of who we are and how we exist. And that's like spontaneous, right? We have to really slow down to untangle all that. Oh my gosh. Okay. So for those online, so Ruby's saying, no one's online, great. We need that one again. But basically for the recording, so Ruby's saying, when we see insects, for instance, and so forth, next bit, Ruby. So instead of,
do you pretend not to see
them? We should pretend not to see them,
yeah.
So that we don't have the intention to see them. So one of the as a beginner, it's taught that as a beginner, what we can do is withdraw our senses. So in other words, it's not that we don't pretend to see them. Like if you're there, you just move your gaze away. And that will stop you, keep your body from having some intention to harm them. And it's the same thing if we find ourselves amongst difficult people and we find ourselves getting upset often when we're around people, we go, did withdraw from people. So that's the first thing. Just withdraw your awareness. So non-virtual stuff can't spring up. Right? Then we try to, through training ourselves, we try to see these beings are just like us. They don't want to be hurt. I don't want to be hurt. So we have this compassion towards them. We understand, actually, these beings actually want to be happy, just like me. So now we have wish them to be happy, just like me. So then we have love. So that's a bigger step up. You'll see even in the Buddhist training, when you start off with killing, they say, don't kill. Right? Restrain yourself from killing. Withdraw the mind from wishing to harm. What's the next step? How about having a wish to protect them, just like we want to be protected from harm? But it's this gradual process. And it's not like any is more right than the other. It's just process.
About a month ago, I had lots of ants going to my offering bowl to where I offer water to Buddha. And I was like, oh, how annoying. I need to change the water. And there's ants everywhere. So I had to work around them, try not to kill them. And then the next day, some of them had gone too far in the water. They were actually kind of almost drowning in the water. And I went, oh, no, like, I've got to get them out. So I got the paper towel, got them out. And then it occurred to me, how often do we get a chance to help save lives, right? Like, I'm not a superhero. I don't go saving people in front of cars, but I had the opportunity to save these little ants. And so suddenly, because of that, it changed the whole thing towards the ants. The next day when they're all drowning, oh, the ants are drowning again. Off we go. Oh, it's still alive. And it just completely changed the whole thing of ants in the water. So, yeah.
So just name, so... with this material, of course, I ask you, what do you find interesting? I know it's difficult for you because when you first hear this, you can't even get together a question, right? The knowledge is so brand new. So I just sort of summarize it all in terms of, and in my way of doing, I just do four steps there. Like, so what's the most important thing to take away from this? What's important? What's easy? And then what's the easiest? So I'll tell you first what the most important thing to take away from what we'll be talking about, right? So it's your mental intentions that define whether an action is virtuous, non-virtuous, or neutral. The most of them, take what was holy, is your intention. Secondly, that actions which are motivated by compassion or non-attachment or non-harmfulness become naturally virtuous, regardless of the outcome. Now, what's easy? Even when actions don't produce intended results, pure motivation still creates positive karma. So this is one of the difficult things for Westerners to get their head around. We're always looking at the action and thinking, oh, this action is the most important thing. It's, no. Why? And this only really comes out, like you say, in the justice system, isn't it? There's lots of actions that are taking place, and they want to know, why did you do it? Once they know why, then the judgment comes across. It's the same with karma. The only thing is, we're the judges. Our mind is judge. If it was negative, you get the negative result. If it's positive, you get a positive result. So, and then last one, I was like, the easiest thing is, remember that the mind leads all the actions. So like a driver determines where a car goes. And so if you think of like the car, it's got the four wheels, so like, there's the four parts. There's four parts right there, the action. But it takes somebody else to like turn the wheel, doesn't it? It's the driver who decides where the car is going to go. And this is what's most important. It's the intention that drives the activity. Where's it going to go? What's it going to do as it's going there? And then, so the final result of it is whatever determines what's made, it's what the driver decides. That's where the car's going to end up. So like us, it's for like, so what's driving your activity? If it's virtue, you end up, the result of virtue is happiness. If your desire to do things is of a harmful nature, a non-virtuous nature, that's the effect you're going to get. Like the idea of the seed turns into the plant. And so like I said, so all, if you look at it, you go, do you want to be happy? You probably say, yeah. Do you want to experience suffering in your life? You've got to go like, no. You go, okay, so what are the actions that produce this happiness? The happiness is like the effect. What's the cause? The cause must be in line with the effect if you want to get that effect. Like I said, you can't plant chilies and expect apples. Right? So you try and bring your activities in harmony with what you want. I want to be happy. Then the activity must be one of virtue, non-harmfulness, generosity. There's lots of mental factors that are very good to create in terms of your motivation. The best being the mind of enlightenment. Whatever I'm doing, I'm doing it to attain enlightenment for you, of all sentient beings. That's the best. Okay, this is our first meditation. Yep, so just adjust your posture to feel comfortable in your seat. Drop your shoulders. Align the spine so it's erect. Have your head sitting naturally on your neck. And then it'll just allow the body to breathe itself. So let's begin with motivation. Why do you want to meditate upon karma, cause and effect? So here we're meditating upon these four parts of an action, and in particular how intentions shape our reality. We want to do this to benefit ourselves, of course, but to also help others. Help others discover the actual causes of happiness and to create those. And what are the actual causes of suffering and to abandon those. So now recollect the four elements of karma. There was the basis, then there was the thought or intention, there was the action, and then the culmination. These work together as an inseparable system. They will create the tapestry of your own experience. When we understand this, we can recognize that our intentions are the primary force directing the journey of this life. So how might you observe your intentions more carefully before acting today? So perhaps you can do this by sort of slowing down, by just pausing to check your motivation before speaking or acting. So if there is a single intention that you could cultivate that would transform your karmic patterns, what might that be? You're looking for some sort of single intention to cultivate, to become familiar with, that will transform your activities. And so perhaps you could consider at least setting an intention of compassion or non-harmfulness before you act. And even better than that would be the intention of becoming enlightened for the benefit of all beings. Let this drive your actions. Now, I'll explain the four elements of a karma. If you've been listening and you wish to understand them, how might this understanding help you take responsibility for your experiences? To help you take responsibility for your experience, recognize that each element of experience, the basis, the intention, the action, and culmination, is within your own power to shape. Right? It's up to each one of you to shape your intentions, your actions. And how they finish. So let intention guide your thoughts, your words, and your actions with a greater sense of awareness. And then decide if you'd like to do that. And then and breathe in through your nostrils. Exhale through your opening mouth. And let your eyes sort of flutter open. Bring your awareness back into the room. Okay, so now the next part of our class is about this, the weight of the action. So they talk about this in different terms, and when you like read, there's a great commentary on karma by Geshe Sopa. And so they talk about what they call the strength of the action, and sometimes like the weight of the action. Other times they use the power. Geshe used on the weekend force. What is the? How do you create intentional force? Or the force once the activity is created. So there are a number of different factors that you need to sort of consider. Again, first of all, is intention. Intention primary importance always in, like I said, it's actually the karma itself. So intention is very important, most important. Then it's like the method. So for most of us, our methods are verbal or physical. And within those two categories, like there's a lot of things you can do with your body and a lot of things you can do with your speech. And of course, it's the how you do it. Thirdly, there's what they call the lack of remedy. So here we're really talking about the karmic weight in terms of negative behaviors. So, for instance, what does it mean by like a lack of remedy? I'm sure you've all done this, so you'd have the experience, but probably haven't been able to tie it to this term. Suppose I want to help somebody, that's my intention. Oh no, let's go the other way. Suppose I want to hurt somebody. And I have my method, and here my method is speech. So I'm going to say unkind things to the person. Right? And there's going to be no remedy to my speech. So in other words, there's no hesitation, there's no embarrassment, there's no sense of shame about what I'm about to say. So shame and embarrassment are remedies. They're antidotes. But I don't have that. Not only that, I don't, and not only that, perhaps there's an unwillingness to say sorry. Now, so many of it, I'm not about you guys, but I find it very difficult to apologize sometimes when you're wrong. You know, apology is a remedy. But here it's like, yeah, you don't do that though. Right? So now it's getting heavier, right? Everyone knows that once, if you hurt somebody, whether it's intentionally or not, if you say sorry, like the whole, you know, lifts up, doesn't it? It gets a bit lighter. So here it's saying, yeah, but you don't. So that's the lack of the remedy. The views. So here, these views in particular would be wrong views. Because in fact, the person wants to be happy and so do you. But you work against yourself when you harm others. You've got a wrong view. Yeah? I think I'm going to, if I hurt them, I'll feel better. I'll be better off. That's a wrong view. You can't get, like I said, you want apples, but you're planting chilies. You want to be happy, but guess what you're doing? You're doing everything that works against it. There's a wrong view involved here. And then the recipient. So like, who is this activity aimed at? So for instance, like I, my mind, when I like this, I thought, yeah, you know, like it's a, this has happened before in Australia, I know, where, so if you're walking down the street and you meet somebody that you don't like and you say something nasty to them, right? That's going to create some sort of effect, right? But suppose you went down to Parliament House and it opened and there's all these people around you and you stood out and you see something really nasty to the Prime Minister, right? That's going to have a very different effect, even though the words won't be exactly the same. So the recipient matters. In fact, this has very often told, it's much worse to create actions against your spiritual teachers because their only interest is for you to be happy. And they're trying to teach you ways to overcome suffering. But you get nasty towards them. That doesn't help you. The other one is your parents. Like your parents like brought you into this world. They put the basis of here. From your mother and father, you have a chance to become an enlightened. Now you harm these people. That seems, you know, heavy. If you hurt children or the defenseless, that's much heavier than like speaking badly to an adult, for instance. So you can see there's lots of nuances in the weight. It's the heaviest karma comes from actions done with a strong negative emotions towards those who have helped us the most. Sort of makes sense, doesn't it? I think when you sort of put it in a sentence like that. The worst effects you will get are effects created by you harming those people who have helped you the most. As a metaphor, you know, so I put this up here, this the ripples of a pond, right? So what's happened here is just a small stone has been thrown in and then the ripples come out. Right? It's a small action, but the effect. Now you imagine I threw in a big rock, right? There's going to be big waves, right? And they're going to go further and there's more power in the reverberations. And this is what it's like, you know, to us. When we harm others who have helped us, then the harm is big for us in the mind. Does this make sense to you? Now, there's a lovely quote about this thing, and I'll just read you the quote, right? So, even a heavy karma, when committed by a wise person, becomes light. But even a light karma, when committed by a fool, becomes heavy. Now, what this is basically saying is if you understand process of karma, you lighten, even though we've all done foolish things. So if we know how the process works, we can undo the effect. Remember, many of the actions, even the wrong things that we've done, we have not yet experienced the effects of them. So they're waiting as potentials. We could experience the harm that's come from many of our past actions. And we will, unless we do something about it. So here's saying the wise person, they do something about it. The foolish person, or the person who doesn't believe in karma or doesn't know how to work with it, they leave their past actions alone. So they increase. They get stronger over time and they produce their effects. This is what sort of the quote's getting at. So to practically apply the knowledge, so each evening, review the activities that you engage in during the day as best you can, right? You won't get them all, but if you've done something unkind to somebody or hurt someone, that you'll hurt yourself, you'll remember that. Yeah? And many of us remember the good things we've done during the day. So you come home, you want to share a nice experience you had during the day. So there's some actions right there. So when the activities have created harm for somebody, which means you've harmed yourself, but regret, the most important is to regret it. To say, oh my God, I wish I'd never done that. That there's regret right there. Right? That weakens the impact of the karma you've created. It can't create the heavy effect as it normally would if you just left it alone. You're actually weakening the effects upon your own mind, in other words, by saying, recognizing that was a mistake. And so here again, here's where we can make another mistake. We blame ourselves for these activities. That would be a mistake. What you need to get at is the action itself. It's the action that's going to cause the effect. You want to stop that. So you're looking at the action and going, that was an unskillful action. It's going to produce a terrible effect for me. Oh my gosh, I'm not going to do that again. So you need regret, and then there's some looking at it and going, these are the terrible future effects that I could experience from this action. I don't want them. That stops me achieving my goals. So I'm not going to do that action again. So this has been forever? Well, hopefully, but that's probably not what's going to happen. So you could say, I'm not going to do this. This is a good time to do it if it's like 9 o'clock at night, right? You've got to go to bed pretty shortly, you say, for the next 10 hours, right? And you will be correct. You will go to sleep. You will not do that action, right? And it's your intention, right? It's your intention. And your intention would have been carried out. You would have accomplished your intention. Then you wake up in the morning, you know, 10 hours, ha-ha, gotcha, right? And now I'm going to go back out into the world again. I guess what, I'm going to meet crazy people with my crazy mind. So remembering what happened yesterday, I'm going to be aware that I could do the same today. I need to be on guard against that. So you try to prevent yourself making the same mistake that you made yesterday. And so you say for today or for the next 5 hours or for the next 1 hour. And if you get through 1 hour without doing it, great. Now set it again. Each time you do it, that's a karma. It'll be complete because you will not have done it. It's terrific for us. And it, you know, it sort of puts it up front and center, isn't it? Because like when the problem we faced yesterday, we meet again today, we've got a lot of resistance. Right? We remember, oh my gosh, it's not going to just spontaneously or habitually grab us and take us away, right? Because we could just, if it was a person, we could just go, well, I'm going to avoid that person today. Not strong enough yet. You know, my buttons are always pressed when I meet that person, so I've got to avoid them. And when you're at home, you go, okay, I need to do more than just avoidance because the seed is still there. I need to actively go against them. What do I do? Ah, remember, that person wants to be happy. Then I wish them to be happy. That person does not wish to experience suffering, then I'm not going to hurt them. And that's what we create an intention and we act on. That's the thing. So basically, how we perform the action matters greatly. So here we come at work. Right? Actions done with strong negative emotions towards those who've helped us most. Now, I know myself, I had a lot of disagreements with my parents, and I'm sure I hurt them. And if you look back over your life, you might have done the same. But try to, if you have done, what helped me was I just remember, like, you know, parents don't actually go to parents' school. They just do the best they can, and they often use their own parents as their guidelines. And they make the same mistakes often as their own parents. They're not enlightened beings. They just do the best they can. Just like us, just like me. So right there, you've got a chance to, like, you know, forgive them. Let go of your own resentment toward them. You remember, they don't know. They didn't know. You know, we're the same. There's lots of things we don't know. You want to be blamed for all the things you don't know? I'm sure your parents don't. Right? Why don't either? And so you can sort of, you know, remember, when we let go of this, we let go of harming ourselves. It's the resentment, it's the negative karma we created in the past that's going to bite us in the present and the future. So we try and, like I said, use reasoning to help yourself let go of how you're holding on to ideas that are going to hurt you. So when you do good things, virtuous activities, do it with as much joy as you can. And when you finish it with satisfaction. I know most of us don't. We just take it for granted and move on. But take a moment to, like, pause there and enjoy it. Not in the sense of self, but just because of the action. Action is good. The action is skillful. Rejoice in that. And of course, on the other side, it's like, be careful, try not to do it. So I just say that here, it just says, look, the recipient or object of your action greatly influences the karmic weight. So actions directed against parents or guardians, spiritual teachers, holy beings, those suffering or in need, close friends who trust you, and this is large animals versus small ones. This is in terms of the harmful activities. So you create greater harm by harming larger animals than you do smaller ones. But in terms of the parents, guardians, all these things, I know for myself, I've heard people who have been very kind to me. If you know you've done that yourself, just admit it to yourself, right? And tell yourself, I'm not going to do that again. And do your best not to. Now, the one of the other things, like I said, is the absence of an antidote. So I said again, when you look back over your past and you see the many unskillful things you've done, what could have you want to arise is what they call a sense of shame or embarrassment. Now, the meaning of shame from a Buddhist perspective is very different than the meaning of shame from a Christian ordinary way of looking at things. So when I never knew that, I made a promise to never ever feel ashamed of what you've done. You've done it, don't feel shame. But shame's a terrible feeling, I felt, in no way. So you just got to wear the responsibility of doing, what you do. Then, when I come across the Buddhist definition of shame, it's like, oh, that changed my mind completely. And because what it's getting at is like, you're having a look at how you've hurt yourself. So shame is that, okay, you, in a way, you've created this negative seed. You've put it on your mind stream. It can only flourish in suffering. So this is like looking inwards and going, no, I don't want that effect. You don't want that effect, don't create the cause. So Buddha's got this big thing of looking at effects and going, what are the causes? They're always looking here, present, what's backwards? Because whatever's here now had a cause. It only exists with a cause. What's the cause? So you look back in yourself and you go, gosh, there's all these effects that haven't taken place yet. Are the causes there? You betcha they are. Do you want the effects? No. So shame tells you, well, if you don't want the effects, don't do the causes. So there's a complete, it was me in the previous one, I look at shame as a feeling of guilt. Like there's something, I'm bad. And I don't like that feeling. I don't want to have that feeling. And I was thinking, that's associated with the shame. That's a bad person, me. Shame is very different when you look at the Buddha Dharma. Very different. Jimmy?
In the Library of Wisdom and Compassion, I like how they use the word integrity.
Uh-huh.
Instead of shame. And so if anyone finds shame really loaded, I just found it really useful.
Yeah.
Think of it as integrity.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's many like loaded words, a good term, Debbie, that will affect you much more strong. And shame is one of the ones that affects me quite strongly. No, regret's different.
Regret follows?
Yes, yeah, for sure. Regret would follow. That's right. It would really help you decide not to do those actions again. So I often say shame is about looking at what happens to you inwardly and embarrassing. It's like this effect on you, what you did. Like that's what you're looking at. Embarrassment is looking at this effect that you did on others. You go, oh my gosh, I did this thing and look how others look at me now. I don't want that. So you restrain yourself again. From heaviest negative karmas, creating a schism, meaning a break within a religious community. And so religious communities are trying to create virtue, basically. And you go in there and break it apart through some way. I mean, this has happened plenty of times before. It's possible. You don't want to do it. So in other words, so you can't actually kill a Buddha because Buddha is mind. But you can draw blood from a human being who is fully enlightened. It's an Arya Buddha. So you can draw blood from an Arya Buddha, but you can't actually kill Buddha. Because Buddha, like I said, is an enlightened mind. You can't be killed. Killing your parents. And this is prone because they brought you into this life. They look at the great kindness that you hear. You've got a chance to become liberated or enlightened. So heavy negativity. Arahats and bodhisattvas, of course, are those who are already engaged in this world for life. And for the bodhisattvas, they have an understanding, they have this great wish to benefit others. So here, you can have that bodhisattva's wish to benefit others, but you also have them that have also realized emptiness. That's like they have realized emptiness and they wish to benefit others. So you kill somebody like that, that's really heavy. But it could also be that the bodhisattva just have an authentic wish to benefit others. They haven't realized emptiness, still really heavy. Arahats are people who have actually realized emptiness and they've liberated themselves from suffering and its causes. They don't want to hurt anybody. They have no reason to hurt anybody and to kill them. That's really, should be really heavy negativity. And lastly, rejecting karma and its effects. That's also very, these are the heaviest negative actions you can create. You're right, Emily. I'm going to move on. So again, from a quote from a great master who took the Dharma to China called Bodhidharma. And here he says, still others commit all sorts of evil deeds, claiming karma doesn't exist. They erroneously or wrongly maintain that since everything is empty, committing evil is not wrong. Such persons fall into a hell of endless darkness with no hope of release. So what he's getting at here is that some people have a misconception of what emptiness means. They don't actually understand it correctly. They think because all phenomena are empty, they don't exist at all. That doesn't matter. Because they're empty, meaning they don't really exist. They're like nothing. So anything goes. But emptiness is nothing. It's not like nothing. Emptiness is not nothing. The emptiness is just a quality of the mind. And these people don't know that. They don't realize that. They draw another conclusion. They draw the conclusion that I don't really exist, therefore you don't. Therefore nothing really matters. Therefore I'll do whatever I want to. So it's sort of like what they call nihilism. Here is positive karmas. So anything that you do towards the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, you can create huge merit, great positive karma from that. Again, it's very useful to work out what the three jewels actually are, because you've got the outer three jewels, meaning your teacher, the teachings themselves, in terms of books and texts and what you see on TV and so forth, the external Dharma. And then an external Sangha, meaning the actual spiritual people that you see. But there's also internal three jewels. This means your own possible, the own potential that you have and everyone else has to become fully awakened. But you serve that, that's a tremendous thing to do. The Dharma jewel means all of your good, every positive good quality that you have. That's your inner Dharma, your wisdom, your compassion. That's your inner Dharma. So all beings have some, some part of that. You know, there's nobody fully evil in this world. There's nobody fully wise. If you're under the throes of samsara, you have the potential. And, you know, there are good things people do, us too. So we've got to recognize that and serve that. And, of course, the Sangha was in the Victorian. Inner Sangha is all about like the whole group of all the good qualities together. You help somebody develop those, that's good, really good. Now, spiritual teachers, of course, are trying to help us overcome suffering and its causes, to abandon them completely and develop our fullest potential. Parents, the people who brought us into this life, gave us this body, the working basis. And those who are suffering. Do you do anything for these people or animals? That's what a good karma. That's right. That's right. That's everybody. Right. So we just have to leave this one again. Again, it's not, I've talked too much to give you guys enough chance. So let's take it. We do our last meditation on the karma, and then we'll dedicate. Again, please just be comfortable. Just let your body settle into the present moment. When you exhale, just release tension. And as we're all gathered here together in this path of awakening, remember that karma, or the understanding of karma, empowers us to create a positive future. So karma becomes heavier based on five factors. There is intention, the most important. There is the method. And in terms of negative karma, there is the lack of antidote, wrong view. And the fifth is the recipient, person we act upon. So when we act with strong emotions or repeat a pattern of behavior, then our karmic seeds grow deeper roots. The karma is like a snowball rolling down a mountain. At first, it's small. It's just a handful of snow shaped by an internal thought or action. But as that snowball moves, its weight grows. So have you noticed that actions towards those who have helped you carry greater impact? And today you'll probably set a few karmic snowballs in action. So just keep your eyes on the prize. Be careful about what you set in motion today. And what small activity could you do today that could lighten your own karmic load? If you can find a small activity to lighten the karmic load, please do it. Now breathing in through your nostrils. Exhale. Okay, so today we looked at karma, the four elements. Somebody tell me the four elements. Good. Intention, action, and combination. Great. That's right. You've got to have a basis. You've got to have something you're carrying it out on, right? And so there are five factors that make karma heavy. This is one you probably forget about, but one of them is like the most important is intention. Of all these, one of the elements, it's always intention. That's the big thing. And here again, too, is what they call the basis, or rather the recipient. There's the action itself. There's a lack of a remedy, and there's a wrong view engaged. Whenever you do something silly or harmful, there'll be a wrong view involved. And often there's a lack of remedy. Just do it. The final is this practical exercise. And like I said, just today, go home and just look at, is there anything unskillful I've done in the past that I can lessen the weight of it? Yeah, there will be, and often it's because you think other people have done something to hurt you or something, right? That's what it often is, to forgive them, you know? Understand your part in what you played. Substantial causes here, they're just contributory conditions. And remember, they're not enlightened, they don't know what they're doing. So for there's some stuff you can read online there, and also, of course, you grab on those books up there. There's a lot of stuff from there about what we talked about. So here we've got pages 7 to 9 and 19 to 30 into the LTC notes. Those books have got the LTC notes, but you also find it up online. So next we're going to look at physical and mental karma, and then its results. So you know, when we come into class, we always set the intention, right? And at the end, we're going to say, okay, that's why I'm here. And now the class is finished. This activity has all come to an end. Now it's come to the culmination. So this is where dedication comes in. You culminate your actions with dedication going, you know, I carry out some activities. I want to, again, set them in the direction of my intention. It stands together. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme dual bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. May wishing as holiness has life, long life continues. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world. To the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, for the successful climbing of Rinpoche's rebirth. In holding and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. incomparable, venerable Guru, to you and make this request. Okay, that's the end of today's class. Thank you very much for being here and paying attention and asking your questions. I really appreciate it. Thank you.